Good afternoon, and welcome to the National Press Club. My name's Clayton Boyce, and I'm president of the National Press Club and news editor for Knight Ridder Tribune News Service. I'd like to welcome club members and their guests in the audience today, as well as those of you who are watching on C-SPAN or listening to this program on National Public Radio or the Global Internet Computer Network. Before introducing our head table, I'd like to remind our members of upcoming speakers. On Tuesday, October 12th, Labor Secretary Robert Reich will discuss the changing American workplace. On Friday, October 15th, President and CEO of Amgen, a biotechnology company, will present a speech entitled, Will the Biotechnology Industry Survive Healthcare Reform? And on Monday, October 18th, the Prime Minister of Turkey, Tansu Çiller, will speak on U.S.-Turkish relations. Other upcoming luncheon speakers include author Stephen King, a debate between Democratic National Committee Chairman David Wilhelm and his Republican counterpart, Haley Barbour, Ian Douglas Hamilton, the former coordinator of the European Economic Community's African Elephant Project, and former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. No relation between those last two speakers, I have to point out. Audio and video tapes of Press Club luncheons are available through the National Press Club Library or by calling 1-800-952-TAPE. If you have any questions for our speaker, please write them on the cards provided at your table and send them up. I'll ask as many as time permits. I'd now like to introduce our head table guests and ask them to stand briefly when their names are called. Please withhold your applause until all the names are read. From your right, Richard Bernard, Executive Editor, Defense News, Space News. Peter Hickman, Freelance Writer and Chairman of the National Press Club Morning Newsmakers Committee. Bill Roos of the Detroit Free Press. Llewellyn King of King Publishing Group. Marcia Stepanek of Hearst Newspapers. Robert Hunter, U.S. Ambassador to the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Reginald Stewart, Assistant News Editor, Knight Ridder Newspapers, and Chairman of the National Press Club Speakers Committee. Dr. Peter Crow, Dean of the School of Foreign Service with Georgetown University. Gordon Smith, the Gordon Smith Company, a member of the National Press Club Speakers Committee, who arranged today's luncheon. Joan Zabo of Nations Business. Kenneth Eske of Scripps Howard News Service. I'd also like to thank staff members Melissa Bender, Pat Thornsberry, and Melanie Abdo-Dermott for organizing today's luncheon. More than 40 years after creation of a mutual military defense pact among the United States and the nations of Western Europe, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization is wrestling with its future. With the threat of another world war seemingly remote and the evil empire of the Soviet Union dissolved, the haunting question today about NATO is out of area or out of business. The phrase reflects an ongoing debate among world powers about whether the world still needs NATO, and if so, in what shape, form, or fashion. It's an especially sensitive issue given NATO's seemingly inability to deal effectively with the civil war in Bosnia, a region that is in its area. Despite some gestures, some people say NATO already acts as if it is out of business. There are a number of ideas afloat about the future of NATO, expanding its reach into other regions of the world as an out of area, or expanding its mission beyond purely military responsibilities. Both ideas and others like it are laced with fears and uncertainty. Meanwhile, the past week's strife in Russia gave pause to those who thought the communist threat was behind us and may have delayed for a while the historic entry into NATO of Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic, all former Warsaw Pact nations. The person steering NATO through this era of transition is Manfred Werner, Secretary General of NATO for the past 5.5 years. Mr. Verna came to the NATO post after serving for 6 years as Defense Minister of the Federal Republic of Germany, where he rose to the ranks of the military in the Cold War era and gained the reputation as a high flyer. Literally, he is an accomplished pilot. He usually flies himself to the United States when he comes to visit. Trained for war, Mr. Verner also has a PhD in international law and has mastered the skills of diplomacy in his current assignment. These skills will become increasingly called upon as he helps chart NATO's future. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the National Press Club, Secretary General of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, Manfred Verner.
Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, first of all, I have to thank you for all these kind exaggerations. If you repeat them often enough, I am tempted to believe them. It's indeed a pleasure, and not only an honor, to be able to address such a distinguished audience this afternoon. And indeed, you did the necessary provocation. So I hope that at the end of my talk, I will at least have convinced you, if not others, that NATO still is needed, even perhaps more than ever. To say that we are living in the best of times and the worst of times is undoubtedly an exaggeration. But it is a fact that we are confronted with two contradictory realities. On the one hand, the resurgence of democracy, still one of the main essential factors in the historic move which we are living. And on the other, a reemergence of war in the heart of Europe, and not only there. Thus, at the very moment we should be basking in the glow of success, we are confronted with nightmare images from Europe's past. Images of Sarajevo, of the Balkan powder keg, and of man's inhumanity to man. In brief, history is back. Isn't it strange? Is it an accident of history that the same themes, at least in Europe, who dominated the first years of this century, now are back again at the end of the century? Clearly, a gap is emerging between our vision of a new international order and these grim realities. We witness peacekeepers with no real peace to keep, nonpartisan sanctions that favor the aggressor, mass murder, the strangulation of cities, and the expulsion of people from their homes. And we thought we had that behind us. We are in one of those crucial periods of history, which we call a transitional period, between the collapse of an old order, the order of Yalta, and the establishment of a new one. Barely visible. Following a period in which international relationships were virtually frozen, the world has suddenly become full of possibilities, both good and bad. And that is typical for phases of transition in history, the ambiguity. The question is whether we will demonstrate the vision, courage, and leadership of the generation of Truman, Adenauer, and Monet, or whether instead we will succumb to the risk avoidance and selfish nationalism which so disastrously characterized Western leadership following World War I. This is the task before us. And this is the task before our Atlantic Alliance. And history will judge our generation by how we respond to it. I think we cannot leave the world to the forces of disorder and limit ourselves to safeguarding our own borders. I think that's a dangerous recipe. And it is not becoming less dangerous by being repeated so often. Neither we in Europe nor you in the United States can afford such passivity. In the world of today, you simply cannot hope to live in security if you are surrounded by chaos. So we have to try to create a more stable, a more peaceful, a freer order. We have no choice. We cannot meet this challenge, the main challenge of our times, without NATO. To provide stability in a world that has become more unstable, you need NATO. To prevent, manage, and resolve major crises and conflicts in the wider Europe, you need NATO. And I come back to Yugoslavia. To prevent Europe from sliding back into renationalization and fragmentation, again, you need this alliance. To keep transatlantic relations working smoothly and effectively, you need NATO. And to face the new kinds of risks, like the ones emerging from proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, again, you need NATO. So this alliance is not sustained merely by nostalgic memories or by purely philosophical reflections on common values and destinies, as important they may be. It survives, and I maintain it indeed prospers, because it serves the concrete requirements of its member nations in North America and Europe. Now I am aware that a different view has been expressed by some in this country, and not only in this country, also over there in old Europe, to whom the international community's failure to prevent or reverse the conflict in ex-Yugoslavia is a demonstration of NATO's irrelevance today. And indeed, it's a very strange thing that others have the responsibility. Nobody turned to NATO to solve this crisis. Others have the responsibility, but we get the blame. Again, I will come back to that. The argument that we should disband NATO because of Yugoslavia is masochistic. In the extreme, it is as if we were to banish doctors for the persistence of illness or abolish police for the persistence of crime. What we need to do, obviously, and that will be one part of my speech, is to draw the lessons of Yugoslavia so that there will be no more Yugoslavia. Now, NATO itself must continue to adapt to a wholly different set of challenges from those we faced during the Cold War. That is why we are holding an important NATO summit in January upon the initiative of President Clinton, with which I just an hour ago discussed the preparation of this summit. Today I would like to point the way towards NATO's agenda for change by addressing three questions. Why NATO? why the U.S. in NATO, and what kind of NATO do we need for this new era, for the new challenge? Why NATO? First, in a world full of crises and conflicts, where history moves fast and is full of surprises, NATO still serves its main strategic purpose, to maintain the common defense and security of its member countries. And you had an experience during the last days of how rapidly things may change, of how unexpected events may happen, how quickly. And one of the characteristics of today is that most of these events are unforeseeable and unpredictable. So, to maintain the security and common defense of its member countries is still a task. But today, we can do it with fewer troops and at lower cost. NATO serves as the insurance policy against the remaining risks and new dangers. And there is no better security and no better insurance on the market. Once dissolved, an effective alliance could not be recreated overnight. Second, the transatlantic relationship is the most stable and valuable geopolitical asset on the globe today. Bringing together the world's two largest trading zones and the two regions with the greatest global outreach and sense of global responsibility. How could we seriously hope to achieve a more stable world without a strategic alliance of these two major power centers? Forget all hope of creating a new and stable order without this alliance. Where else but in NATO could these power centers, North America and Europe, coordinate their policies and pool their capabilities to deal with major security challenges, as was done so successfully in the Gulf War. If we do not act together, no one acts, or the US will have to do it alone. And I have my doubts that the US is prepared to do so forever. Moreover, the countries of Central and Eastern Europe already rely upon the stabilizing influence which the alliance exerts around its periphery. The end of NATO would increase the risk of conflict in Europe dramatically. They all want to come in. If this alliance would be so outdated, why then would they wish to join? Very simple. I think this alliance can provide its member countries something which only the Roman Empire, if I look back into history at its height, could provide. Security, factual security guarantee for all its member countries. You are in, you are safe, you are out, you are less. Next. The American presence provided for a stable balance between former rivals and enemies in Europe. It even made possible the realization of German unification without a major crisis in West European politics. And I was witness, and you can imagine, it was one of my greatest moments, if not the greatest moment of my life, when under my chairmanship as a German, the United Germany became a member of this alliance. By contrast, the dissolution of NATO or the disengagement of the United States from Europe could, and I'm sure would, undermine the European integration process. This would be damaging not only for Western Europe and the United States, but also would gravely affect the political and economic transition of the countries of Central and Eastern Europe, which are urgently looking for links to the political, economic, and security institutions of the West. Fourth, NATO is, I'm tempted to say, the only organization that possesses the right package of political military tools for effective crisis management. It provides the bedrock of hard security on which any new security order must be based. Now, which other instrument could you turn to in a crisis situation, assuming the political will to act is there? And that's one of the keys, the answer to your question. Of course, you need the political will to act. You need the political will to use this instrument. The Yugoslav crisis demonstrates not NATO's irrelevance, but its vitality and its potential, and I'm going to prove that. For the first time in our history, we are both acting out of area and through our commitment to conduct airstrikes poised for actual combat operations. NATO has offered its support to the United Nations, and it has done everything the United Nations has asked, and the alliance has done so efficiently. We could have done more, no question. Nobody turned to us, and none, I repeat, none of our member countries at an early stage wanted NATO to act. We are enforcing the embargo at sea and the no-fly zone in the air. Our planes are flying at this very moment over Bosnia-Herzegovina. We have also offered the United Nations our protective air power, and it worked. The moment NATO threatened the use of airstrikes, the strangulation stopped. All of these tasks are being performed with the professionalism and dedication you expect from this alliance. So I'm not going to take the blame. Why the US in NATO? A strong NATO is not only important for Europe, but it is also critical to American security interests. The US will not be able to pursue domestic renewal successfully without peace and stability in Europe, a region where your geopolitical stake remains paramount. Even excluding Russia, Europe embodies the largest collection of military power and potential. It is also a key geographical, strategic, and logistical link to the Middle East and Persian Gulf areas. NATO members, including the US, hold 6 of the 7 G7 seats, make up 16 of 22 members of the IMF, and hold 3 of the 5 permanent seats in the United Nations. Moreover, America and Europe have never been so dependent on each other for their economic well-being. And that dependency is steadily growing. NATO allies are collectively the United States' largest trading partners. Two-way trade between the US and EC in goods and services alone was close to $400 billion last year alone. US exports to Europe and European investments to the United States have created millions of American jobs. So you protect your own interests over there, and not only the interests of the Europeans. And stability there is crucial for them, but also for you. Since it is obvious that the United States cannot prosper amid chaos and conflict, I think it needs the alliance as the most important vehicle of US influence in Europe and the main instrument of US leadership. Now, NATO costs the U.S. proportionately little for great return, and the good news is that those costs are going down. Planned U.S. cuts in European-based forces are at least double the total reductions by all other nations, NATO nations combined. By 1995, the burden of stationing U.S. forces in Europe will be cut by more than half from Cold War levels. Now, America's most important stake in Europe is peace. Here, there is one very simple lesson. Whenever Europe and the United States go separate ways, they pay a terrible price. Twice in this century, the United States has withdrawn from Europe at its peril. Twice this century, the Atlantic democracies have been brutally reminded that their security is indivisible. These are lessons which I think we simply cannot afford to relearn. So those voices are clearly wrong which advise Americans to declare victory, pack and go home. A superpower simply cannot take a sabbatical from history, not even a vacation. We need United States leadership. I say that as a European. Without the leadership of the U.S., there will be no leadership at all. And most likely no meaningful action in crisis situations. You may regret it. I regret it. But it's a fact. That does not mean that you have to share the burdens alone. You can and you must expect your allies to shoulder their share all the burden and the responsibilities. But let me say very clearly, it is therefore better to remain in Europe and prevent wars, with reduced strength, of course, than to leave Europe and have to return to fight again. Now the way ahead. NATO has not stood still since the end of the Cold War. Contrary to what some think, this alliance has changed more than any other international institution in the last 3 years and remains a state-of-the-art model. We have had to accept two new missions to meet the demands of a vastly changed security environment. A, projection of stability to the East, and B, crisis management. We have adopted a new strategy, new force postures. Most importantly, we have established close relations with our former adversaries by creating the North Atlantic Cooperation Council. And we have started participating in crisis management beyond our borders. So, Mr. Chairman or President, if I may reply, the slogan out of area or out of business is obviously out of date. We are acting out of area, and we are very much in business. Only to characterize one of the revolutionary changes of this alliance. If you would have predicted me 5 years or 5.5 years ago when I took over, that there would be a day when under my chairmanship, the foreign minister of Russia and of the United States, of Ukraine and of Italy, of Great Britain and Kazakhstan, of Poland, Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, and Belgium, Germany, France, would sit together in one North Atlantic Cooperation Council, I would have recommended medical treatment to you. And that works. So we have turned around from confrontation to cooperation, fulfilling our new role. Now still we need to continue to adapt the alliance to play its role in stabilizing Europe. Let me briefly list four main areas which we shall be at top of the summit agenda. First and most important are where change must come, area where change must come is in further developing our ability to project stability to the East. Security is the oxygen of democracy. If we want our new democratic partners in the East to survive and to flourish, then we must seek to give concrete meaning to our 1991 declaration that our own security is inseparably linked to that of all other states of Europe. This means that we must transform the North Atlantic Cooperation Council to address the real security needs of our partners through stepped-up consultations and joint action in peacekeeping. Moreover, we should now open a concrete perspective for expanded NATO membership. This will be a lengthy road, and we need to act gradually, carefully, and flexibly. But the important point now is to commit ourselves in principle to begin traveling down that road. Doing so, even if enlargement is not for today, would increase the stability of the whole of Europe, particularly if we are also willing, and we are willing, to enhance fundamentally our security relationship with Russia. There is reason to do so. The same holds true for Ukraine and other cooperation partners. Let me say, nobody will be isolated. Not Russia, not anybody else. We intend to build bridges and not barricades. Second, we must achieve a more balanced sharing of burdens and responsibilities between the two sides of the Atlantic. Hence, the importance of Western Europeans clearly demonstrating their willingness and capacity to do more. This means that the further development of the Western European Union as the European pillar of the alliance is not a threat to NATO's survival, but rather the precondition for ensuring its long-term future. And you should see it this way. Third, we must further develop the alliance's capabilities, forces, structures, and procedures for crisis management, peacekeeping, and peacemaking. And we must achieve a more structured relationship with the United Nations in order to generate the conditions which are essential for future crisis management. Clear-cut mandate. A better coordination between humanitarian and peacekeeping, peacemaking missions, and a unitary chain of command. This morning I was on the Hill. And I tried to explain that there is and will be a difference between Somalia and Bosnia. If NATO is tasked to implement. We must understand and take to heart the lessons of our collective failure in the former Yugoslavia. We must consult among ourselves far in advance about potential future conflicts and undertake the necessary planning for such contingencies. We must intervene with diplomacy backed by force and the credible resolve to use it, if necessary, at an early stage of crisis, as so as not to be confronted as we are today in ex-Yugoslavia with a much higher cost of reversing aggression. We must be willing to contemplate limited military options for limited diplomatic objectives so as not to be hamstrung as we are today with an all or nothing mindset. We must, if we are not willing to help the victim of aggression, enable him at least to defend himself. We must define the strategic objectives of our actions as early and clearly as possible. We must avoid situations in which our own troops become hostages, thereby preventing military action. And above all, we must possess the will and the initiative to utilize the instruments available, amongst them our alliance. Fourth and finally, we must maintain a significant level of well-trained, well-equipped armed forces. The stabilization of defense budgets is now urgent if we are to avoid a kind of free-fall structural disarmament. Let me terminate. I firmly believe that our generation still, I repeat, still has a better opportunity than any other generation ever had in the long and bloody history of this century to build a peaceful Euro-Atlantic order. If we fail, this opportunity may never return. We can only succeed if we stay together and understand that our security is indivisible. Your great and still vital nation has an enormously important mission, and without exaggerating, I say of historic dimensions. We need your presence, and even more so your leadership. But you also need Europe, for it is only by moving forward together that we can hope to shape a better world and a better future for our peoples. And that remains our objective. Thank you very much.
You made reference in your speech to the United Nations past suspicions about NATO. Now is NATO becoming the United Nations standing army?
Indeed, when we started to cooperate, there have been some clear reservations, not so much on our part. Still, NATO is seen by some as a Cold War organization. They do not realize the changes and the transformation. But it has improved very much. We have now established a good working relation. Tomorrow I see again the Secretary General of the United Nations, which is now, I would even call that a regular event. But to answer your question very precisely, we have offered our support to the United Nations for peacekeeping missions. But we have done so on our own decision. We are not the subcontractor and not the extended arm of the United Nations. We help them, but we do it on our own decision. That means the Council decides. Our 16 member countries decide if, how, and when we act in support. So we are independent organizations, but we try to establish a true, a real partnership.
What did you and President Clinton accomplish in your meeting today?
Well, we discussed primarily the preparation of the summit meeting of this alliance. We discussed those items which I tried to bring to your attention a few moments ago. It is clear that this summit happens at the crucial juncture of history for the alliance, for Europe, for the United States. So obviously, we have to make decisions. Decisions on how to intensify cooperation with the East. And we discussed that. Second, how to strengthen the European pillar without damaging this alliance. And we discussed it. Third, crisis management, including Boston. Now, first of all, this was a talk which served the preparation of a summit, no decisions, of course, being taken. And those talks make only sense if you keep a certain confidentiality. Otherwise, we could do it in speeches. So I think it was not only a very fruitful talk, but it produced some results, at least in my mind, hopefully also in the mind of President Clinton. Next.
What do you make of Senator Pell's statement yesterday that the United States should not provide 50% of the peacekeeping forces for Bosnia, but much less?
First thing I have to say, that I very much understand the emotions and the feeling in this country. This morning I called my wife, she's in Brussels. She told me she was crying when she saw the picture at our television of this body of an American soldier dragged through the streets of Mogadishu. So believe me, I understand fully the sentiment of many, not only on the Hill, but also of many Americans, if not most. But we should not draw the wrong consequences. The lesson is not to do crisis management in the future, not to participate in the implementation of a possible settlement in Boston. The lesson is to do it the right way. And what does that mean? I think President Clinton was right in clearly stating some conditions. Which I fully support. Clear command structures, NATO command structures, under the overall political authority of the United Nations. It's no problem. But NATO will handle that, at least the military part of the operation, if the United Nations turn to us for support. Clear definition of objectives. So that once they are achieved, you can leave. That means you have a restricted, a limited mission, not an illimited. Rules of engagement which allow you to be efficient and successful. We have made first plans. And I am confident, this being a very difficult undertaking, if there is a peace settlement, if the United Nations ask, that we could do the job, but we could only do it with American participation. Now, you rightly expect, and that was the point of Senator Pell, that your European allies participate. But allow me to say that some of them are down there with ground troops since over 1 year, have suffered losses, casualties, have paid sacrifices and prices. And I'm sure that they will continue, some even reinforce. So this time it's not a question of going it alone. Now as to the amount, 50% or 45 or 55, I would not at this very moment publicly debate those figures. What you can expect and what you will get is a fair share taken over by your allies. But without American participation, I'm afraid we could not do the job. But we will make sure that they happen under conditions which do not repeat experiences in other locations. Forgive me for being a little bit lengthy, but I thought it might be useful to say that.
What would be the effect on NATO if the United States were to walk away from its commitment to send peacekeeping troops to Bosnia?
Well, simply we could not do the job, and that would mean you have a settlement. That's the condition number one. to which all three parties agree. Whatever you think of such a settlement, and I will not comment it, I have my own opinion on that. And already the Muslims have told us that they can only envisage signing such an agreement if NATO is prepared to participate in the implementation. So can you envisage a situation in which we would turn our back, would say no, with the consequences, winter coming, war resuming? Who would take that responsibility? Again, you would have television pictures, which would be frightening, even perhaps more frightening than also today. So that's why the North Atlantic Council, and Ambassador Hunter is here, with his vote, in his presence, decided our principal preparedness to participate. The final decision has to be made when the settlement is there, when the United Nations have asked us, and when we know the exact conditions. Then we will make the final decision.
What portion of NATO costs did the United States pay in the 1980s, and what should it pay in the 1990s?
Well, your share is, if I am not wrong, 28.5% or 28.5% of the budget. By the way, the overall budget of NATO, civil and military, is $1 billion only. NATO as an organization. The Germans are paying 27%. Then follow Britain and France, I think with around 18 or 16%. That's all what is in my memory at this very moment. So I think compared to what you get out of this alliance, I dare to say it's not too much. In the future, your share will be reduced. Firstly, because you reduce your troops and your commitment, and that drastically. And we've also reduced the expenses on infrastructure, and again, that reduces greatly your contribution. The percentage will remain the same, because if you start dealing with percentages, you will unravel things and you will not get a better share tomorrow.
What do you say to American critics who say that European nations in the past have failed to adequately defend themselves or pay for their own defense?
That is partly, only very partly, I would say yes. Some could have done more. But the picture which is the underlying picture of this question seems, to me at least, to be wrong. Even times of the Cold War, European troops made more than 70%, 75% of the share. And in financial terms, of course, Europeans contributed much more. And if I look into the burdens other than finance, I have my own experiences. I was 6 years defense minister of a country which had, at that time, the size of Oregon, with around 500,000 own soldiers, around 500,000 foreign soldiers, low flying, so that in certain regions of our country you could not have a funeral decently without at least 2, 3, 4 times a jet, with all what it meant for the population in other areas. Of course, they did it, because it was in their own interest also. But I can tell you there were burdens which we had not, they were not easy to maneuvers. Not like in the United States on training grounds, but through towns and cities, with all what that means. Only to give you an idea that it is not the picture which some have here in the United States, that you did the job and the Europeans stood there and did nothing and just accepted that you take their job. That's a caricature, but not the full truth. But I would like to restate that I would have wished myself in the past, and still wish, that some do more. And definitely, the burden has already shifted more towards the European side, and will continue to do so.
President Yeltsin has opposed East European countries joining NATO. What is NATO's reaction to that, and what should the reactions of Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic be to that statement?
They have already reacted. They don't need my advice. I would say two things. The first is President Yeltsin can be sure that this alliance means partnership. If it says partnership. And that means that we envisage a security system in the wider Europe, which of course does not exclude Russia. We will not isolate it. I repeat what I've said in my speech. We will not isolate. We will develop with them, and not only by words, a strategic partnership. On the other hand, the summit will have to decide upon enlargement. But I think we will do it in a way which takes into account the legitimate security interests of our partner, Russia. I've been twice to Russia. Once to the Soviet Union, visited Gorbachev. That was after the decision in Rome, in London, of our summit to extend the hand of friendship. I did so. I was received well, and then we started to cooperate. I was seeing President Yeltsin, I think it was after the summit in Rome, and we reconfirmed that partnership. So the Russians must know this alliance is not the adversary, the enemy of yesterday. It is the partner of today and hopefully the friend of tomorrow.
What is the timetable for these Eastern European nations to join NATO, and what is likely to happen to those nations which are not included in NATO?
I cannot give you any timetable because we have not taken any decision on that. We have just started a discussion. It was one of the points I discussed with President Clinton. So I personally have, but this is my personal opinion, I have some doubts if we get a timetable. Because that's obvious that the summit will not decide to take X or A, B, C, D country as a member tomorrow. That will not happen. What I expect is a principle declaration. This is a process which we start. So I have my doubts if we will come to timetables or name countries or so. But again, I can only give you a personal view on that. NATO has not yet decided. It will have to decide all those questions on the summit.
Should NATO be reorganized to place more emphasis on non-military functions, and if so, how?
We have already changed this alliance considerably already. I mean, this has always been, even if people did not look at it this way, this has always been a political military alliance, never a purely military alliance. It was always a community of destiny, of action, of values, of interests. It played always a political role, also a political role. But of course, in the times of the Cold War, it was overshadowed by the military part. But now, clearly, the political role of NATO has become stronger. And that is reflected in the structural changes we have made. We have enlarged, to give you one example, the political department of my headquarters, diminished others to reflect this change. I sometimes spend 40, if not 50% of my time with cooperation partners in the East. There are some weeks where I spend more time with dealing with our cooperation partners, that means politically dealing with them, than with our own member countries. The question of disarmament, the question of consultation on security matters, practical cooperation in how to deal with crises and conflicts, peacekeeping. These are all matters for political discussion. So I expect that political side of NATO to continue to gain weight. On the other hand, let me clearly state that, of course, the backbone of this alliance remains its military strength. Once that's over, you can disband it. It can only exercise its stabilizing role as long as it is seen as a powerful organization and institution. That's the reason why you have to leave some of your troops there, not to fight wars, but by their pure presence to prevent wars in the periphery. And I'm sure that by the pure existence of NATO, we project stability already, and we have to reinforce that. But again, only if we remain strong enough to be seen as powerful enough to deter wars, to deter aggression.
Before asking the final question, I'd like to present you with a certificate of appreciation for appearing here today and a National Press Club mug, Colin Powell had so much to say about when he was here.
Could you tell me what you said? Perhaps I can repeat it.
He said, "Don't give me some cheap mug."
That makes the difference between a retired general and a NATO secretary general.
The last question is...
You give me my best regards.
Yes, I will. The last question is, how is the United States' new ambassador to NATO doing? And I would like you to ignore the fact that he's sitting two seats to your left.
I would have forgotten if you would not have reminded me. He is doing a great job. He creates sleepless nights for me. Now, really, we are satisfied with the choice. In the short time, he did very well to establish his reputation, which, of course, he had already with me since we know us a long time. Thank you very much indeed, Mr.